Could climate change change your property taxes? What can we expect now after the Proud Boys pardon? And will Trump really try to take the Panama Canal from Panama? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll discuss the new proposal for Miami-Dade County's new property appraiser, Tomas Regalado, to calculate climate change risk into our home values. Are we even allowed to say climate change? We'll also look at the possibility of a resurgence here of the hate group Proud Boys after the presidential pardon of January 6th convicts like Enrique Tarrio. And we'll examine President Trump's threat to take away the Panama Canal and drive away China. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenido, bienveni, bienvindo. We're certainly aware here in South Florida of how climate change and global warming affect the way we look at property. Rising sea levels, for example, are the big reason wealthy folks who own oceanfront digs in Miami have suddenly been looking at real estate in more elevated neighborhoods like Little Haiti. But up to now, most of us really hadn't thought about how climate change affected the value of our homes, specifically the taxable value of those homes. Miami-Dade County's new property appraiser, Tomas Regalado, thinks we ought to be thinking about that, which is why he recently said he wants to include climate change factors, disastrous flooding, for example, into the calculation of property value and therefore property taxes. And despite the potential for downgraded county revenue as a result of potentially downgraded property assessments, Miami-Dade County Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava said this week the idea is, quote, well attuned to 21st century realities. Do you think climate change should be taken into account in our property appraisals? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio here is Miami-Dade County property appraiser Tomas Regalado and former Miami mayor, we should point out. Also here with us is the lead climate change reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald, Alex Harris. My thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Mr. Regalado, let me start with you because I know climate change mitigation was already something high on your agenda when you were mayor of Miami a decade ago, when you led the charge, for example, for a bond issue to help the city and its residents confront challenges like sea level rise and flooding. This past November, you were elected Miami-Dade County property appraiser in a landslide. Did you take that as a sort of mandate to confront climate change in your new job as well?
Absolutely, Tim. And I was frustrated all these past years since I left the city of Miami because I really push and the people believe in the bond issue that we call Miami Forever.
Right.
$400 million that it's been since 2017, it was approved. And I don't know exactly what is going on. So when I got to the property appraisal, I has this feeling that we need to start a conversation that never happened before at the office of the city appraisers, I think throughout the state of Florida, maybe throughout the nation. So that's why this week I created a task force of executive in the office of the property appraisal, and we're trying to get help from the mayor. I'm meeting with the mayor. I'm meeting also with the property appraisers of Broward and Palm Beach to run this by them to see what's going on.
Obviously, they have the same concerns there,
absolutely,
everyone in South Florida. But why, aside from climate change mitigation, did you feel that local government here should also start factoring in climate change into how our homes and properties are appraised for tax purposes?
One of the things that I noticed in the city of Miami, and by the way, maybe Alex can give more detail. She's more into the numbers and investigation. 40% of the city of Miami, it's under this flood plain area.
Right. Flood plains.
And this is troublesome. when every time that there was a king tide, Shortcrest, which is a very quaint and beautiful neighborhood on the northeast area, yeah. floods up to your knees. And I was there. I walked the flooded yeah. street, and I saw people putting furniture in, and then they told me, well, we have to take down the sheetrock, we have to rebuild. So it is happening. We have the septic tanks, which is yeah. a very big deal, because many people buy a house without knowing.
Very good point.
Does
yeah.
you have
yeah,
a
because
septic
tank? Because that's going to be a big factor. Yeah.
And then if you want to connect, uh-huh. it would cost you several yeah. thousand dollars. So. Yeah. This is it.
My home, for example, still has a septic tank,
okay.
and I often wonder.
Sorry about you.
I often wonder about how that could affect, the valuation. But I think folks in Miami-Dade County and across South Florida, frankly, as you've mentioned, would agree with you. But I think the question they have, Mr. Regalado, is how will this work? How will you and your office calculate the effect of climate change risk when you appraise the taxable value of the almost a million homes and other properties here? You mentioned to me earlier that you've already set up a task force for this. How are they thinking then of making this work?
First, we have to get information. We don't know what we don't know, but we know that there are studies. We know that there are people that are scientists that understand. We know the report from UM that satellites show
University
that,
of Miami.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that people that buildings are sinking, in the coastal area. We have $1 trillion investment in the coastal area from Aventura to almost the Keys.
Yeah.
And we have a responsibility of advising the people that listen, we have an issue. And
right.
it's not that it's coming in 50 years.
Right.
It's here. We saw it during Irma, the storm surge
right.
destroying half of Brickell Bay Drive.
So it's almost like, making sure you advise people about sinkhole factors and things of that nature. Alex Harris, you are in fact working on a project about climate change and property values for the Miami Herald. So I want to turn to you here and ask you from the perspective of a climate change expert, is this a long overdue notion, taking climate change into account when we determine property values in a place as climate change vulnerable as Miami-Dade County and South Florida are?
Yeah, this is one of the biggest questions looming over South Florida's economy, right? Real estate is what makes the engine go of
yes.
our economy in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have we don't have income tax. We have property taxes. They are what makes local government move. And for many years, research has been piling in from all around the country and all around the world, suggesting that people are perhaps paying more for property value than it's actually worth down here, that there's an overvaluation of our homes, of our commercial spaces, of our buildings, because the risk of climate change, flooding or fires or heat isn't being factored in.
Uh-huh. That's a great point. What, to your mind then, Alex, are the biggest climate change factors that are natural considerations for a policy like this? I mean, I think you just mentioned a few.
Yeah, so the number one risk we worry about in South Florida is flooding, right? So as Regalado just said, about 40% of Miami, the city of Miami, is in a floodplain. About half of the people who live in Miami-Dade County are under an elevation of 6 feet. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people. Florida has more real estate at risk from just a few feet of sea level rise than any other place in the nation.
Yeah.
And so when we think about, these are the king tides we're talking about, the regular nuisance flooding. Well, maybe it's not such a nuisance, and maybe it's a real hazard when it goes from flooding your street and you can't drive through it to getting inside of your home. It costs thousands to tens of thousands of dollars to fix a flooded home,
mm-hmm.
or the one-time punch in the face of a hurricane and storm surge soaring into your home. These are these repeated stresses or these rain-driven floods. We all remember the massive rain bomb that Fort Lauderdale saw just mm-hmm. a few years ago, and the big rain events we've seen since then. These are supercharged by a wetter, warmer climate, and they are causing flooding to become much more regular. And that's something that's not really factored in, experts say, to our property values.
Under this factoring logic, then, for example, when I bought my house, I was was told explicitly, you are not in a floodplain. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing then would potentially then raise the value of my home under this...
Would lower the value. So over time...
Because I'm not in a floodplain?
Well,
absolutely.
We think about the value of your home might be higher because you don't flood, but just because you're not in a flood zone doesn't mean you don't flood. That is something we've really learned, right? These FEMA flood maps, they're binary, right? You're inside a flood zone, you got to pay for flood insurance, you're out, you don't. That is not a good marker of our
risk. So under this scheme, we'd be taking a much closer and more detailed look at these factors.
Briefly, 40% of the insurance claims of flooding comes from houses that are not in the flooding map nation.
But Mr. Regalado, how though does this fit into what I believe are the 8 property valuation criteria that the state of Florida sets out for determining the taxable value of our homes and businesses here? Does a county property appraiser like yourself have to operate within the parameters of those criteria? And if so, how would they accommodate a new standard like exposure to climate change risk?
Because you can do it. It's up to now, the appraisal office has been using highest and best use, thinking that we know what these people are going to build in the future in that piece of land. Actually, what the property appraisal has been doing throughout the year is valuing the land and not the building. I think that we have income, location.
The real estate mantra, right?
I mean, you're a home, you're not in a flood plan, but you're going to flood.
Right.
Every time that there are like 3 inches of rain, Brickle and 13 is flooded.
Yeah.
The arch in Biscayne Boulevard is flooded.
Yeah.
Mary Brickle is flooded.
And I should mention, because of that, even though I'm not on a floodplain, I do carry flood insurance. Yeah.
Right. But you know, in Olita, in the north, we had rains, regular rains, and the county had to take people to hotels and motels because their home flooded.
But the bottom line is, you do feel that this new approach you're proposing fits into the criteria that are laid out for property appraisal.
Because it's about income,
appraisal.
It's about value, it's about location.
Alex Harris, do you see this perhaps as an incentive for both Miami-Dade County government and Miami-Dade residents to get more serious about climate change mitigation? I mean, if my house is in a flood zone, let's say, and that's going to drag down perhaps the value of the biggest investment I'm likely to make in my life, do environmentalists, for example, hope that that makes me and my community more invested in resilience efforts, but also in efforts to reverse climate change itself?
Yeah, I think people really hope that what gets people's attention is money, right? Everyone's more yanked around by their wallet than they are by most other factors. And that's where everyone has sort of, from an academic and expertise era, has been watching insurance, right? Insurance is supposed to do that.
Glad you brought that
in. Your flood insurance, your home insurance, if it goes up, it means it's riskier to live where you live. If it goes down, it means it's less risky to live where you live. Mm-hmm. Generally, that's the proposition we all understand. If your home value goes up, it means, hey, this is a desirable place to live. If your home value drops, this is a less desirable place to live. Those are the market signals that we already expect people to look for. And so when people talk about what does it look like when more climate damages are happening to us, the floods are more regular, they're destroying more homes, the signals we expect to see are your insurance becomes more unaffordable and your home value declines. So far, property taxes have been mostly left out of that conversation. When we talk about property taxes and home value, mm-hmm. generally the conversation is they probably have to go up, right? Because we need more money to fund the pumps and the road raising. But that is a really interesting proposition of the idea of, okay, if you're potentially as a resident losing value of your home because the government maybe isn't doing a good job protecting you, or because sea level rise is just sort of inexorably rising, what does that mean? How should the government respond? I think that I've never heard of anyone tackling property taxes the way that Miami-Dade is talking. It's really a nationally leading idea.
And we're going to get to that tax issue right now. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Miami-Dade County property appraiser and former Miami Mayor Tomas Regalado and Miami Herald climate change reporter Alex Harris about factoring climate change into the taxable valuation of our homes and properties here. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. 1-800-743-9576. Now, Mr. Regalado, of course, the flip side to this is that while factoring climate change risk into my property appraisal could potentially reduce its value, it could also potentially reduce my property tax obligation, as we've been pointing out. That, however, raises the specter of reduced Miami-Dade County revenue. At a moment, for example, when we're trying to figure out how to confront a waste management crisis here. But Mayor Levine Cava looks to be on board. And my understanding from your interview with WLRN's Tom Hudson this week, for example, is that you don't foresee this causing a significant dent in Miami-Dade's finances.
Well, all my colleagues, and I call them colleagues because they're commissioners, I have been a commissioner, mayors, understand that we have a housing crisis, that we have a lot of people unhoused, that we have elderly, homeless, trying to survive because they cannot afford their rent.
Right.
The local governments are the first frontier for complaints of the residents in Miami-Dade County and everywhere. So I am sure that my colleagues, I am positive that my colleagues would really want somebody to take a jab at the housing crisis in various ways, mm-hmm. and try to help with the housing crisis rather than get a very high amount of dollars.
Revenue.
So
okay.
There will be most likely a decrease in revenue, not that much, but listen, I dealt with budgets. And I said when I took office when the bubble happened,
right.
And I said I don't want to kill a city to save a government. And the reason for that okay. is that we were able not to raise taxes. Mm-hmm. We tightened the belt. We put a cap on the pensions, and we survived, and the city survived.
Alex Harris, just quickly along those lines, were you yourself surprised to see Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine Cava approve of the county appraiser's proposal here to pursue a policy tool that could potentially shrink her own budget?
It is interesting. I mean, it all depends entirely on how things work, right? How many homes, how much devaluation are we talking, how much decrease, how much increase? There's a lot of particulars that have to be figured out. But generally, when we look at the bill to pay in the next few decades to adapt to rising seas, increasingly intense storms, and higher temperatures, it's pretty expensive and seems like you'd need a lot of money. And if you don't have income tax, property taxes generally has been what folks have leaned on in local governments.
Right. So this is going to be a tough balancing act. Finally, I just wanted to ask both of you about the political elephant in the room. Mr. Regalado, I want to ask you about not just the economic, but as I said, the political considerations of all this. As you're well aware, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has made it verboten to even use the term climate change in official state business. Do you worry as a result of your proposal then that this might provoke state preemption, as we've seen many times before recently, on his and the legislature's part to block what you're trying to do? And if so, how do you plan to defend your proposal against that?
Actually, it could happen. It could happen. But at the same time, we're talking about septic tanks, something that we have to deal with immediately right now. We're talking to sea level rise that is happening. We're talking to a storm surge. And we have seen what happened in the west coast of the state of Florida. So I don't see any initiative saying, well, property appraisals are not permitted to compound in the value adjustment of any property, the fact that you have a septic tank or the fact that you are in a flood zone.
Alex Harris, just quickly, in the 20 seconds we have left, do you see any sort of political backlash as a result of a proposal like this?
State government reports by the governor's own chief resilience officers have included the risk to property values dropping from sea level rise. So it's a concern that the governor has himself expressed an interest in and something the state has a vested interest in.
Good to know. Tomas Regalado is Miami-Dade County's property appraiser. Alex Harris is the Miami Herald's lead climate change reporter. Many thanks to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Still to come, what now after the Proud Boys' pardon? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. One of President Trump's first actions after his inauguration this week was to pardon or commute the sentences of the almost 1,600 Trump supporters charged or convicted in the violent and seditious insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Seditious because they were trying to overturn the legal, constitutional certification of the results of the 2020 presidential election that Trump lost. Among those pardoned was Enrique Tarrio of Miami, who was serving a 22-year prison sentence for seditious conspiracy. Tarrio leads the right-wing hate group known as the Proud Boys, a sort of Trump street enforcer gang, which led this menacing, door-pounding protest against then-Democratic minority leader Nancy Pelosi during her 2018 visit to Miami. Tarrio returned to Miami on Wednesday and insisted that those who prosecuted him for January 6 needed to, quote, pay for what they did. Trump pardoned other Proud Boys as well, all of which raises the question, will we now see a resurgence of this group here? Let us know what you think. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Rachel Carroll Rivas. She's the Interim Director of Intelligence Projects at the nonprofit Southern Poverty Law Center, a hate group watchdog in Montgomery, Alabama. Rachel, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I just want to start by helping people understand why watchdog groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center designated the Proud Boys a hate group in the first place. What were the criteria that led the SPLC to make that decision?
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, for 50 years, we've been looking at these hard right, anti-democracy, anti-civil rights hate movements in the U.S. And so we've got a lot to compare it to be honest.
Right.
And, you know, McManus and the Proud Boys self-describe themselves as Western chauvinists. And although they have claimed that they disavow bigotry, their actions, their words, and what they've done over the last few years have just gone right into the face of that. That's included explicit white nationalist sharing of memes and messages and content in their online channels, protests and demonstrations where they are right there countering civil rights movements, LGBTQ events, Muslim events, and also, you know, they're cross-organizing with fellow far-right white nationalists and the neo-Nazi movement at events like Unite the Right have been part of the reason that we know that they really fit into that category of a hate group in the United States.
Would we include the group known as the Oath Keepers, for example, in that category?
Yeah, we consider Oath Keepers part of the hard right, but really much more part of what we call the anti-government movement. Folks would be familiar with things like the militia movement, those who were involved in the Oklahoma City bombing in the 90s, the kind of direct actions with weapons against government by the Bundys out west a few years ago. So, you know, that's really where Oath Keepers fits. They're a militia anti-government conspiratorial group.
What is about the history of the Proud Boys specifically that stands out for you, Rachel, in terms not just of how it was founded, but how it proliferated so, dramatically about a decade ago?
Yeah, that is a great question. I think the thing that stands out to me now looking back is how explicit they were about being anti-woman and anti-feminist and about really redefining male supremacy in the U.S. That has become a real core tenet of the modern white supremacist movement. And it's always been part of it, but really they brought that to the fold.
Right.
I think the other thing is that like Oath Keepers, they had a real national infrastructure with chapters that was pretty successful. They used online organizing tools pretty effectively and were able to have that structure. Mm-hmm. Now, there's plenty of things to talk about how that hasn't gone well for them since then.
Now, you heard that audio of the 2018 Proud Boys protest against Nancy Pelosi here in Miami that I played at the outset. Is that the sort of intimidation or menacing tactic that sort of characterized Proud Boy events during their heyday? I mean, we so often see in photos from that era, its leaders and members wearing military get-ups and patches, for example, with slogans like RWDS, which stands for Right Wing Death Squad, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It really is meant to be a movement, and this is how it's organized, you know, Proud Boys as well as their fellow, you know, co-organizations, and that is to be intimidating, to really shut down the ability for people to have dialogue, conversation, vote, democracy, public events, you know, that support inclusive, diverse communities. I always say that, you know, democracy can't happen at a barrel of a gun, neither can it happen when someone threatening to bring a gun.
Right. And I remember during the 2020 elections when we were hearing the Proud Boys saying that they were pretty much intending on intimidating voters. That was the very moment, was it not, when President Trump told them infamously, I guess, in that debate, stand by or stand down,
yes,
but stand by, correct?
Yeah, that sort of stand back but stand by phrase really emboldened groups like Proud Boys and really solidified them and others within the hard right militia movement as what you might consider an unaccountable second arm of government. And that just really is absolutely counter to what we have in our country as an infrastructure. We're supposed to have police who are accountable to the public, right? We've got public schools. These are entities that are supposed to represent all of us and, you know, keep us together and to uphold the ideas, values, and policies we decide. It is not appropriate to have this sort of second arm, not accountable, not voted on, doesn't have the same policies. That kind of rhetoric and that kind of call to arms, but with like a wink and a nod, is absolutely dangerous.
Right. And when we talk about the RWDS, the Right Wing Death Squad thing, a lot of folks, I mean, is this an accurate fear as well, that they become sort of a street enforcer group for a political party or movement in much the same way we've seen street enforcer groups operate for sort of dictatorial governments in Latin America? Again, going back to that Right Wing Death Squad identity they like to promote.
Absolutely. I mean, we have history of, you know, absolutely violent vigilante justice across the South in the U.S. And that, you know, really took place as part of the history of lynching of Black people who did not get a fair trial. That was one situation we can point to in our own history. But yes, absolutely, across the globe, from, you know, Latin America to Europe, these are meant to be terms that bring to mind violent moments of the past and intimidate people so that they don't show up and they feel like they have to stay in the shadows.
Now, most of the attention from this week's presidential pardon was focused on Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio of Miami, as I said, who had been convicted in 2023 of seditious conspiracy in the January 6th Capitol riots, even though he wasn't present there. He was serving a 22-year prison sentence. Rachel, when you examine a character like Enrique Tarrio, what stands out in terms of the kind of person, especially the kind of young man, who gets drawn into a hate group like this?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. You know, for a long time, we've been able to answer the question of who does this stuff? Where do they do it? What are the tactics they use? And, you know, where's it happening? But I think what we're really leaning in on now is how do we prevent it? And absolutely that starts at identifying those sort of triggers that open a young person up to being susceptible to manipulation, misinformation, being pulled in by folks who are trying to tell them that they have a group identity that is more valuable than another. And absolutely some of this happens online, but not only. We know that some of this is prevented by making sure folks have asked those questions, they have strong adults in their lives who are aware of what's going on, and that when you have young people like Tarrio who got involved in this, someone can interrupt it, because I don't think most people in the U.S. actually think this is a positive way to live their lives.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Rachel Carroll Rivas of the Southern Poverty Law Center about the possible resurgence here of the hate group The Proud Boys as a result of President Trump's pardon of several of its members for their roles in the January 6th insurrection. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. And as a reminder that if you miss any part of the program, you can search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. So, Rachel, I want to bring things up to the present moment. As we mentioned, Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio was now released from prison and is back here in Miami. Before he received President Trump's pardon, you may have seen his attorney made it sound as though he was contrite and apologetic about his role in the January 6th insurrection, for which he is a convicted felon. But as soon as Tarrio arrived here this week, he lashed out and said the people who prosecuted him, for example, need to, quote, feel the heat and pay for what they did to him. The presidential pardon has obviously emboldened rather than humbled him. And that, of course, leads us to ask, are we likely now to see a resurgence of Proud Boys and its activities and influence? And if so, what does that mean for communities like ours here in South Florida?
I think our major concern right now is that we've got folks with political power who are aligned with groups like Proud Boys. So one question is if they will even be necessary to have a ground game, if what they wanted is just being done in policy. But I think that, you know, it's important to point out that all things are not sunny for Enrique Tarrio. There are absolutely Proud Boys who are happy, who feel vindicated about his release. But at the same time, the online conversation about Tarrio, because of his supposed cooperation with federal law enforcement, is pretty negative. And in fact, the Proud Boys has actually sort of divided themselves into two distinct groups in the last year or so. Mm-hmm. They have a standard chapter who have distanced themselves from the former, who are part of the following the former leader, Tarrio, and then national groups who are chapters who are distancing themselves from him. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they're, you know, calling him names. The group did not show up on Inauguration Day. We've seen a lot less activity across the country in the last few months, yeah, and a significant decline in chapters. But I think the concern I have is about the larger movement, yeah, not necessarily Proud Boys themselves.
But you mentioned that political link earlier. This is a special concern here in South Florida because we're talking about many more Proud Boys figures here than just Enrique Tarrio, another prominent Proud Boy member who was pardoned for his role in the January 6th riots is Gabriel Garcia, who before January 6th had actually been a member of the Miami-Dade County Republican Executive Committee. How deeply should we be concerned about that sort of thing, you know, carrying on after this?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's where my main concern is. We know that hate groups, you know, including white nationalists, have used tactics like demonstrations, encouraging, you know, violence at times, you know, that sort of public displays, that very showy kind of actions. But they absolutely use political strategies because that's where power is gained. And so I think that is a high concern right now. And I think that door is unfortunately pretty open by many people in politics, but I don't think that door is open by the public. So I think we're going to see pushback from individuals who sort of are going to begin to say it's just a little too far.
Right. Still, though, going back to that, what we talked about, that statement that President Trump made in 2020 to the Proud Boys, stand back, stand by. Yeah. After these pardons, do you see hate groups like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers having the same sort of presence and influence under President Trump's second administration that they had during his first presidency? Is that possible?
I think it's possible for sure. I think, you know, there are many things that are fairly similar to a few years ago and some things that have dramatically changed. I think I have some concern about folks sort of being you know, apathetic to what they see because it's become a bit too normal. I also think that if there is very chaotic federal policy actions, you know, executive orders on weekends, immigration raids, et cetera, within chaos, there is an opportunity for strongmen to to rise to additional power. And that could be at the local level or the federal level. We've learned that from, you know, democracy that had fallen around the globe. So I think we really have to have our eyes open. I think folks got to sort of say and do the right thing. And I also think we should take that opportunity when we see these kind of fissures and divisions within movements like the Proud Boys right now, and really make sure we point that out, because they will align if we let them.
Okay. Rachel Carroll Rivas is Interim Director of Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Rachel, many thanks for your perspectives. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Still to come, will President Trump really try to take back the Panama Canal? This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. In his inauguration speech this week, President Trump doubled down on his plan to take back the Panama Canal from Panama. The U.S. handed the canal to Panama 25 years ago under a treaty, and most experts agree the small Central American country has run it quite effectively. It now handles 6% of the world's maritime cargo traffic, two-thirds of it coming to or from U.S. docks like Port Miami and Port Everglades. Trump insists, falsely, that U.S. ships are being overcharged for using the canal, and he claims China now operates the canal, not Panama. That, too, is patently false. But it does raise a big reason Trump wants to seize the canal. China has recently invested billions in infrastructure projects in Panama, which has alarmed Washington. All of which is why it's no coincidence that Trump's Secretary of State, Miami's own Marco Rubio, will make Panama his first foreign visit next week, we're told. Meanwhile, Trump has nominated Miami-Dade County Commissioner Kevin Marino Cabrera as the next U.S. ambassador to Panama. We'd like to hear from you about all this. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Leland Lazarus. He's the Associate Director of National Security at Florida International University's Gordon Institute for Public Policy and an expert on China's presence in Latin America. Also with us from Panama is Alonso Ijueca, an expert on international law at the Universidad Santa Maria La Antigua in Panama City. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Let me start here with that moment in President Trump's inaugural address when he confronted Panama and China.
And above all, China is operating the Panama Canal, and we didn't give it to China. We gave it to Panama, and we're taking it back.
Okay, Alonso Ijueca, as I said, that's a false claim that China is operating or running the Panama Canal. But I want to start with you because after Trump's inauguration, I saw a sort of twofold response to all this from Panama itself. On the one hand, Panamanian President Jose Raul Mulino made it clear that the canal is Panama's and it has no intention of letting the U.S., quote, take it back. But on the other hand, we saw Panama move to audit the Chinese company that built and operates one of the main ports adjacent to the canal. Is it possible that Panama received President Trump's real message here, which was start getting tougher on China?
Of course, Tim, and that's a possibility. It's a real possibility that the Panamanian government received a message from President Trump. But I wanted to mention the previous statement on the speech of President Trump upon being inaugurated in office.
Right.
Prior to referring to the Panama Canal affair, he mentioned President William McKinley.
Right.
Former President William McKinley. And for me, that's a crystal clear message that he's trying to send the Panamanian people, because President McKinley presided over U.S. ascent as a global superpower. He basically presided over the takeover of Puerto Rico, the takeover of Cuba, the takeover of the Philippines, of Guam, even buying out Hawaii. And also, he presided over a very significant moment in the history of Panama, because during his presidency, his Secretary of State, John Hay, signed the Hay Pouncefoot Treaty with the United Kingdom, which basically cleared the way for the U.S. to build
right.
the canal.
To go ahead and build the canal, right, yeah.
Yeah, for me was very significant that he mentioned President
right.
McKinley.
Right. So that he's sort of trying to make Panama think back to when the U.S. was flexing its manifest destiny muscle back in those days, and that it could happen again, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So basically, he's trying to bring back the 19th century power politics.
Gunboat diplomacy. Leland Lazarus, can you help our listeners get an appreciation, though, of just how much infrastructure investment China and Chinese companies have made in Panama, and why, as I mentioned at the outset, that has alarmed Washington in terms of hemispheric policy?
Well, ever since 2017, when Panama officially ended diplomatic recognition from Taiwan
right.
and changed to the PRC.
People's Republic of China.
The People's Republic of China, exactly. Right. We've seen a marked increase in trade and investment and infrastructure projects on the part of the PRC in Panama. Actually, my team here at FIU, we have a Chinese activities dashboard where we're tracking all of PRC investments and projects throughout the region. And you know, you can sort of see in Panama some key ones, right? So for example, Hutchinson Holdings, which is a private company that's based in Hong Kong, had a 25-year lease over two key ports. And they, since 2021, they won another 25-year lease. You've got China Harbor Engineering Company that built the Amador Cruz terminal in Panama. And you've got another private Chinese company called Landbridge that has created the Colon container port in Isla Margarita.
Right.
These are just examples of, you know, many projects that the PRC right. has.
And one of these companies is the company that Panama says, well, yeah, now we'll go ahead and audit them. We'll lean on them a little bit, maybe to make President Trump happy, no?
That's correct. That's correct. And you know what? Obviously, the Chinese are not operating the canal. But there is a point in terms of potential national security concerns or implications, right?
Right.
What are they? I think one is if there's ever a conflict between, say, the U.S. and China over maybe Taiwan, and the U.S. would need to move its naval assets quickly from the Atlantic to the Pacific to support that effort, they need to pass through the Panama Canal, right?
Yeah.
And so it is kind of a little concern of a Chinese company, even though it's private, mm-hmm. You know, still is beholden to the PRC central government.
Yeah. Alonso Iueka, let's examine that claim that President Trump made that, quote, China now operates the canal. Secretary of State Marco Rubio echoed that assertion in his confirmation hearings, insisting that because China operates so much important infrastructure around the canal, like ports and bridges and roads, it might as well operate the canal itself. Do Trump and Rubio have a point there, Alonso, or is this an exaggeration?
I do believe it's an exaggeration because we have to draw a clear distinction between influence and control. We have to draw a clear distinction between influence and operation. But I certainly agree with Leland's remarks, and I do believe that the government of Panama agrees with him in the sense that the Controller General just a few days ago called the Hutchinson Ports, CK Hutchinson Holding facilities in Cristobal and Balboa, a colonial enclave that replaced the Americans.
Uh-huh.
And this is me quoting, this is me giving you the exact quote.
Again, Hutchinson being a Chinese company, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
And so in that regard, there is certainly concern, but there's also a material fact that we cannot ignore, that the neutrality regime that the U.S. and Panama built after 1977 is basically a military alliance to protect the canal. And it is not only protected by the U.S. and Panama, it's also protected by other 40 states, including the Republic of China, that is right. Taiwan.
Okay. Leland Lazarus, if this is the case, though, doesn't it seem to a certain extent that the U.S., including the first Trump administration, has itself to blame quite a bit for not trying harder to partner with Panama in projects like infrastructure at the same moment China started jumping into the country a decade or so ago, as you pointed out?
A great point. I think that over the past several decades, Latin America and the Caribbean has been deprioritized in terms of U.S. engagement. Of course, the priority has been the Indo-Pacific. But I think that is certainly changing. I think it's quite heartening that Secretary Rubio's first visit abroad will be to Panama, right, in order to
Right.
really start to strengthen U.S. engagement in Panama.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with FIU's Leland Lazarus and Alonso Ijueca at the Universidad Santa María la Antigua in Panama about President Trump's plan to take back the Panama Canal. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. We have listener Michael on the line here from here in Miami. Michael, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your perspectives on this dispute?
Hey, thanks for having me speak on the show. I just want to try to get an angle of the conversation geared a little bit toward the idea of generally breaking treaties. The idea that there's this other component of the problem of Trump with this and the Paris Climate Treaty, that nobody can make a treaty with the United States anymore, whether he's the president or in the future any president. It's a factor that I don't think Trump considers that. Who wants to make a treaty with the United States now?
Right. No,
completely meaningless.
Sets controversial precedent. Good point. Alonso Ijueca, along those lines, let's look more closely at that threat Trump has made to take back the Panama Canal and even use the U.S. military to do it. What are the international law obstacles he faces, including that 1977 treaty Michael just mentioned that transferred the canal from the U.S. to Panama? Could he ever really realistically do this?
Like, legally speaking, he cannot do it. Like, in the sense that he will be violating every single treaty that the U.S. has come into since 1945. But I will also include the Brian Kellogg Pact and also the UN Charter. Like, the UN Charter is very clear. You cannot use force or threaten to use force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. So it's basically nonsense. And I completely agree with one of the viewers when he says that no state will want to sign any type of treaty with the
right.
U.S.
But we should
I will go even further. I will say that we will be witnessing the undoing of the liberal international order,
right,
in the sense that the U.S. is basically emulating what President Xi or the dictator Xi is doing in the South China Sea,
right,
and of course what Vladimir Putin is doing in Crimea,
right,
and broadly in Ukraine.
So there would be a hypocrisy factor too. But there is, in the 1977 treaty, Alonso, a provision that allows the U.S. to use its military to preserve the canal's geopolitical neutrality, right? Is that something you think Trump might exploit in all of this?
So there is a joint commitment between Panamanians and Americans to defend the canal. That clause that everybody is mentioning in the media is called the De Concini Amendment, the Concini Reservation, which is actually a unilateral interpretation made by the U.S. Senate. As a matter of international law, that has no legal value, because that will basically contravene the U.N. Charter. And in the event of a conflict between the U.N. Charter and any other treaty, the UN Charter prevails, as established in Article 103 of the said instrument.
Mm-hmm.
So I do get that from the American perspective, there is kind of an argument to be drawn upon, in the sense that you could understand in some sort of a way that you have a unilateral right of intervention, but that was never the purpose of any of the texts adopted jointly by Panama and the US.
Mm-hmm.
The only other reservation was one jointly signed between General Torrijos and President Carter, which states that the only way in which the U.S. can use military force is to deter some type of attack to the canal against
right.
foreign adversaries, not against the Panamanian people, which
okay.
aren't doing anything to deserve this.
Leland Lazarus, in the minute we have left then, from that national security standpoint you were mentioning earlier, short of taking the canal back, which looks very unlikely, what can the U.S. do then to push back on China's presence and influence at a site as geostrategic as the Panama Canal? And we only have about 30 seconds left.
All right. I would say to boost Panama's ability to stop potential surveillance on the part of the PRC, right? Espionage. So we've seen in other areas in the region where when a Chinese company builds the port, you also see ZPMC cranes, right? You see
yeah.
New Tech with port scanners. You see Huawei with telecommunications and Dahua and Hikvision for cameras, right?
Yeah.
All that information can go back to Beijing and can be used for,
Okay.
nefarious purposes.
Well,
So make sure that
Leland,
there's no
unfortunately,
industrial surveillance.
we'll have to leave it there, unfortunately, for time. Leland Lazarus is Associate Director of National Security at FIU's Gordon School of Public Policy. Alonso Ijueca is an international law expert at the Universidad Santa María la Antigua in Panama. Gentlemen, many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Finally on the roundup, the Lunar New Year starts next week. WLRN's Jimena Romero visited one of the South Florida Lion dance teams that performs the traditional Chinese spectacle.
3 bright yellow and orange lions dance to the pounding beat of the drums. Each costume is operated by 2 dancers from the Lee Kun Hong Kung Fu Association, a martial arts school in Sunrise. Luke Boxer is one of the dancers performing. The 20-year-old is also an instructor at the school. He started as a student there at the age of 4.
So with the drumming and the cymbals, you get the sound and the vibration. And with the lion, you get that strong sense of feel with deep movements.
The ancient legend says the lion dance was used to scare off lions that terrified a village in China. Nowadays, the dance is believed to bring good fortune. In the Lunar New Year celebration at the Southwest Focal Point Senior Center in Pembroke Pines, the audience feeds the lions with red envelopes filled with money.
They're feeding the lion to basically bring good luck and good fortune to themselves, to their family, and to everybody.
Boxer says their dance team gets booked every year from January to March to perform in all kinds of events across South Florida. 2025 is the year of the snakes, a symbol of wisdom, intuition, and transformation in Chinese culture. I'm Jimena Romero in Pembroke Pines.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. The show is produced by Jimena Romero. Katie Munoz is our Director of Original Live Programming. Mateo Sanchez is Digital Editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's Vice President of News, the Vice President of Radio, and the show's Technical Supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias. Merci. Obrigado.
WLRN.